Hello, and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle Radio. Each week, the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in finance take you beyond the numbers and hype, right to the heart of the big issues of the day. Today, we're discussing a new report from the UBS Sustainability and Impact Institute, entitled Green Hockey Sticks, Are Key Climate Technologies Breaking Through? The author of the report is here to tell us about how they identified vast potential emissions reductions through climate tech. However, as they'll explain, the reality is a tricky road ahead, as most climate techs are too immature to easily scale and are economically uncompetitive. We'll consider how processes might be better designed, both to better understand complex dependencies, but also to better inform strategic policy, investment, and organizational decisions. We'll hear about where financing gaps exist in the climate tech sector, and consider ways that innovative solutions can address those gaps and drive progress at the pace and scale we all need to move the needle and address the urgent climate challenge. Let's meet the report's author. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show, William Nicol, ESG analyst in the UBS Sustainability and Impact Institute. William, great to have you with us once again. Well, before we get into the detail of the report, tell me what your frames of reference were. What were the objectives at the outset?
So the starting point was looking at climate change as a sort of technology-led story. So if you look back in history, it's replete with examples of technology breakthroughs, which are basically a better solution emerging, replacing a worse one. And you can really see examples everywhere. And they can be as simple as like horses being replaced by canals and then eventually cars, or you know, lighting sources where, for example, candles have been eventually replaced by nice, cheap, modern light-emitting diodes. And climate change is really a similar process of kind of new climate technologies, which is any technology that helps reduce emissions, replacing kind of carbon-intensive technologies. And a clear example, for example, is electric vehicles replacing internal combustion engine vehicles. And you can really see this process of climate technologies replacing carbon-intensive technologies already happening in some areas today. So I gave an example there in transport. Another sector where it's clearly happening is power. And you can see this with solar in particular, which has seen really rapid cost falls in recent years, as well as with wind power, to the extent that now renewable power is 86% of all new capacity additions on a global level. So this kind of transition from carbon-intensive technologies, the old world, to these new low-emission climate technologies, the new world, is already underway in some sectors. But a key sticking point with this transition, which can sometimes be forgotten if you look back at just how, you know, horses were eventually replaced by cars, is that it's not a smooth process and it can be quite a bumpy road over time. And today, a lot of climate technologies are actually not commercially competitive. They could be quite high in price. They might not be as convenient as the existing technologies. So, for example, if there aren't enough electric vehicle charge points out there, you might not take the plunge on buying an electric vehicle, even if it was as cheap as an internal combustion engine vehicle. And this is a key sticking point because you're not going to see climate technologies increasing their market share so long as they're uncompetitive with existing technologies, because they simply kind of won't be invested in if there's not a kind of clear sustainable business model. Consumers might not want to simply buy them if they can get a better product elsewhere, even if they're the same price. And so the entry point for the report was really asking what key technologies are needed for climate change, how quickly do they deploy, and are they reaching those points where they get competitive with incumbent technologies so that you could see them start to outcompete and the existing technologies and therefore increase their market share? Because that is really the fundamental condition for these technologies to build at the rate that they need to build that to meet climate targets.
And let me ask a follow-up question, because I think that's the nub, isn't it? That we know the scale of the climate challenge and the fixes need to have the same mass scale deployment. But even these technologies, as you say, that have great potential, progress can lag. And that is often because of difficulties in scaling and because of a simple economic lack of competitiveness. So once you've identified that, what is the next stage? Is it looking at, I don't know, improving processes, whether that's adoption or how some of these interesting interdependencies work? How do you turn that observation about what needs to happen into something that can offer a bit of a blueprint for how to actually get moving at the speed we need.
Yeah, well, it's certainly more of an art than a science. It can be quite hard to actually just identify what makes a technology competitive in the first place. And in the report, we went about creating a framework for this. And often the kind of approach to analysis here is kind of more down the street of sort of ratings and such, because it can be quite hard to quantitatively compare to unalike technologies. So the first point to sort of start making a framework there is to look at the conditions along which technologies are competitive. And we divided this into a slightly corny phrase called the four C's, which is each dimension of kind of competitiveness, if you like, for a climate technology to sort of reach this point where it's competitive and you might have a tipping point where then it starts seeing its market share rise lots, is the point where sort of the technology ticks these four boxes. And I won't go into a huge amount of detail here, but they are cost. So is the technology the same cost as the incumbent one that it's trying to replace? Is there sort of good non-cost features too, which we call convenience? So for example, going back to EVs, are there enough chargers around? Looking at, say, green steel, is it as strong as kind of conventionally produced steel? So it can just be a direct substitute. Then we also look at two other dimensions, which are perhaps less consumer-facing, and one is compensation. So does the technology offer, say, viable business models today which can attract investment? And then finally, the last dimension is compatibility, which is looking at whether the technology faces sort of large supply-side bottlenecks or there's other kind of systemic factors that mean it's not very compatible with today's world. So on the demand side, for example, you could look at social norms and whether alternative proteins really appeal to consumers on subjective factors such as sort of taste and smell. And so rating the technologies along those pillars is a way to gauge competitiveness and really identify whether they're sort of close to those points of suddenly building their market share. The question of, which was your question, Tom, of what you then do to poke them more towards that point is really sort of dependent on the technology, but there's a range of different levers you can pull in terms of innovating more, trying to sort of attract more investment. There could be a range of different policy incentives. And in the report, we kind of don't answer those questions as much because really you could write a whole separate report on each individual technology. The point we're trying to make in the report is that evaluating technologies through this kind of competitiveness lens is a key way to sort of raise the profile of which technologies are close to competitiveness. And through a little bit of effort could then sort of be nudged forward to a point where, let's say, their price is equal to the incumbent technology or their quality is improved a little bit to make them suddenly appeal to consumers. And you could then see them sort of organically build their market share through markets rather than, say, relying on policy support. So we leave the what needs to happen question as a little bit of an open one and just sort of rest on the fact that we highlight some technologies are kind of close to these commercial tipping points and others perhaps you wouldn't see them building their market share rapidly without lots of intervention until the sort of late 2030s and beyond.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting, which is this idea that as well as understanding what informs whether something is at or close to a tipping point, is you have to acknowledge where that tipping point process itself is. And there is this longer train. And that's very important, isn't it? I guess, particularly because much of the progress or lack of will be defined, hindered or aided by policy and regulatory issues, right? So all the different stakeholders need to have a better understanding of when we're likely to hit these tipping points, at which point we can then introduce these frameworks and prisms through which to view the matter. It is really important to understand the tipping points better, isn't it, perhaps, than we do currently?
Yeah, exactly. And you need to also think about how they work kind of across the piece, because climate technologies are actually quite related to each other. So if one scales quickly, it can increase the chances of others scaling quickly. A neat example of this is batteries, which although they're kind of an input to lots of, let's say, mobile phones, electronic devices all over the world, like 85% of demand for them is related to energy. It's in things like the power sector to kind of store energy in the day when the sun is shining, solar panels, and then release it at night, or particularly in electric vehicles. And as the prices of batteries fall, which they have been very rapidly in the last few years, it suddenly makes other climate technologies a lot more feasible. So suddenly electric vehicles become a lot cheaper because batteries are sort of one of the most significant cost components of the actual sticker price on your electric vehicle. Because wind and solar have these pretty classic intermittent generation problems, so they can't always pump out power to meet demand. They need batteries to sort of help balance supply and demand and make them more feasible. as a sort of majority generator on the grid, and the full on cost of batteries help with that problem immediately. So it's not just that, you know, understanding the individual tech process, but trying to zoom out and have an idea about how these climate techs work together in a world where we're sort of slowly progressing towards net zero is really important to make sure the process is viable, but also kind of can happen at the pace that needs to happen to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement.
William, let me ask you a little bit about financing, because this is another thorny issue that I think the report unpacks in a really interesting way. There's a risk appetite, I guess, amongst certain, if you look at venture capital, for example, which can often help the sort of newer entrants in the climate tech space. And then obviously there are more established ones who are further down the line who, you know, maybe they can get access to institutional money. The report makes this interesting point that maybe there's a bit of a kind of a squeezed middle, and I make those speech marks here, who I guess are sort of slightly trapped between the two, right? There's still a high risk. They need to push their technology, but they can't scale to bring the cost down. They're kind of trapped in the middle. And this was a kind of an angle that I hadn't really considered before. And it's quite a live issue, right, in this space.
Yeah, you're completely right. So a lot of climate technologies, as I said, it's quite a broad group, but a lot of them are sort of new hardware that has never been built before, right? And these are things like a green steel plant that needs to build its first kind of a plant. It sort of proved the viability of its technology, but suddenly it needs to prove that it can work in a commercial setting. And for that, it needs a lot more money, essentially, and investment. And in recent years, there's been a lot of kind of venture capital money that's been happy to help the pre-commercialization stages, these sort of high risk, but not that much investment needed in the grand scheme of things. But when technologies get to that kind of stage of commercialization, where they suddenly need much larger check sizes, let's say north of $50 million, they're still a little bit too risky to appeal to where the bulk of money exists in the financial market. So this is much more towards the sort of low risk institutional investor end of the financial mandate spectrum. And so they're at this point where they're too risky to appeal to most mandates in financial markets, but they need a lot of money, which can only flow their way if they meet the sort of conditions of those mandates. And so there's some interesting things you can also do to try and kind of correct that mismatch. One is trying to increase the sort of investability of climate techs, and that's really a sort of product innovation type job. So things like securitization has done that in the past, where you end up with different kind of financial players taking different slices of risk. But the more active area that we've seen in the last few years is from this sort of new breed of active investors and philanthropists and family offices who really try and use their networks to innovate in a way that addresses the unique risks that these climate techs face. So a good example is an inherent risk to these sort of brand new technologies is that nobody knows whether there'll be demand for their product when you build that first factory. So let's go back to green steel. You build the green steel factory, you start producing zero carbon steel, but it's more expensive than regular steel. And you know, are people in the market, you know, are they focusing just on price, or are they willing to sort of pay that big premium for the new green steel? And this can stop, prevent developers getting financing for their first green steel plant, because let's say banks will not be able to basically have a view on whether those risks are large or smaller. So using their networks, these kind of new active breed of investors will link up the developers with corporates and get promises from the corporate. Let's say it's a car manufacturer who needs a lot of green steel to meet its climate goals while it produces the next generation of cars. They'll get promises from that corporate that they will buy the green steel, and they're willing to pay that premium if the developer hits a certain price point. And then that kind of gets around this catch-22, because it gives the developer a piece of paper that can prove to financial markets that the demand risk is low. They already have a promise to buy their product, and that enables them then to attract the investment to scale and then actually do the work of reducing the costs and developing their green steel plant. So those are a few ways around it, but ultimately, you know, the transition will be a really capital hungry process, and lots of innovation will be needed to sort of ensure that climate finance can flow to investable opportunities over time.
Really interesting on that tipping points point, I guess I could phrase it. Tell me a little bit about, because the report unpacks this in more detail, which I found really interesting, in terms of, you know, where these points might lie by technology. And perhaps you could just unpack that for us in a little bit more detail in terms of what we should be looking for when it comes to that process of tipping past the point of no return, if you like.
Yeah, sure. So the report looks at around 20 technologies. So I'll save your viewers the dry narrative on a technology by technology basis, but you can kind of group the findings into a few different buckets of technologies. So the first group is quite an optimistic story that some climate technologies look like they've already passed this commercial tipping point. You know, they're already sort of cheaper than the technologies they're competing against. They offer kind of really convenient non-cost features and not that larger infrastructural barriers. And these include things like solar and wind and utility scale batteries. And the sort of common theme across all of them is that their prices have just been tumbling in recent years. And this means that over time, they're probably just going to make up a larger and larger share of the market. And then the findings for the other technologies were a little bit more kind of pessimistic, but it really highlights that the areas where you need to address improvements in each technology. So one group is, for example, where they're approaching tipping points, but not until maybe later in the 2020s or the early 2030s. And this shows that they are rapidly increasing their deployment, but perhaps not at the pace required by climate goals. And this could be things like electric vehicles, where the sort of price parity with internal combustion engine vehicles is not really expected until late in the 2020s. And that can sort of every year that is delayed, it really slows their rollout. And the sort of the difference between the pace of their rollout today and that needed in net zero scenarios is so fine that each year really matters for those technologies. So the final group were really these technologies where tipping points lie beyond 2035. And that was sort of our decadal horizon, if you like, in the report. And for these technologies, it's not clear on current trends that they are going to improve and become competitive anytime soon. And so really it highlights that they should be the focus of more kind of policy incentives to reduce costs and deployment efforts. So one example here is, say, like new synthetic fuels, which will be really important to decarbonize things like shipping or aviation, where there's fewer decarbonization options. And so we're likely to need to produce these kind of, if you like, synthetic fossil fuels through electrified means. However, like things like synthetic jet fuel, its price premium today and the outlook for it is so much higher than jet fuel. It's not clear that it will ever be able to compete on a cost basis with jet fuel. So it highlights that you need things like blending mandates today. So encouraging airlines to use more and more the synthetic fuel to sort of raise demand to help reduce cost. And then possibly also other levers going forward, because the technology is unlikely to scale by itself.
And that's William Nicol, bringing us to the end of this edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance each week here on Monocle Radio. You can listen again at monocle.com and follow the programme wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, do discover more and find out how UBS can help you at ubs.com. If you'd like to read more from William and his colleagues at the Institute, head to their pages. Go to ubs.com and search for the Sustainability and Impact Institute. And I'll add, the Institute has also published a series of climate tech passports, which provide deep dives on each of the technologies included in the report. This is The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle Radio. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.